StartupRad.io, your podcast and YouTube blog covering the German startup scene with news, interviews, and live events.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Joe from StartupRate.io, your startup podcast and YouTube blog from Germany. Today, we bring you another interview in connection with our attendance of Curious 2024. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Professor Stephen Chu here with me. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
You are a Nobel laureate and former U.S. Energy Secretary, Professor. You're holding the William R. Kanan Junior Professorship of Physics, Molecular and Cellular Physiology at Stanford University, and you've made groundbreaking contributions to the fields of laser cooling, biophysics, and renewable energy. This interview is conducted in connection with the Curious 2024 held in Mainz, promises to delve into Professor Stephen Chu's work. Just a tiny bit. We won't take up too much of your available time. Let us start right away with our questions. As someone who observed and influenced energy policies in both the US and Europe, what do you see as the main difference between the two regions in terms of supporting and nurturing green and energy startups?
Well, I would have to say that Europe, especially Western Europe, has been much more in the forefront of trying to make a transition away from carbon-emitting technologies to green tech. I think the exception would be in the Biden administration. The Inflation Reduction Act was a very, very huge support in terms of mostly tax breaks to further green technologies. But before that, I think Europe has been a leader in trying to stimulate this transition.
Just my pure personal assumption, if a Republican president would win again, I don't think those energy breaks will live any longer than necessary.
That's probably true, although there was an attempt in the legislation, for example, in stimulating, trying to create a market for a hydrogen economy. There is no market. Substantial tax breaks were put into the Inflation Reduction Act. And the hope was, in, I didn't really study the law that closely, but I've been heard that it's there for 10 years. Now, anything could happen if a Republican administration comes back in, because they're clearly not in favor of that. In fact, that candidate has said very loudly he's going to go back to drill, baby, drill.
I do believe he says a lot quite loudly. Let's go to the next question. Europe has been at the forefront of renewable energy initiatives for years. In your opinion, what lessons can US green startups learn from their European counterparts to enhance their growth and impact?
Well, one of the things that I'll specifically mention, Germany, first they started with strong subsidies to promote solar, but they did more than that. And that really started the interest and eventually for temporarily the overproduction of solar, which drove the prices down. But we are now in a position where solar is continuing to make great advances in lowering the cost. But the thing that I admire a lot is when I was Secretary of Energy, I was looking at why is Germany, which doesn't have as good sun as the United States by far shot, why is Germany leading in solar? Why are they actually doing this? And one of the things I noticed was that they made the process of a homeowner wants to put solar on their roof or small business, they made it very easy. In the United States, it was determined by state, by local cities and counties, and they actually made it hard. They wanted to use the licensing of solar on a rooftop as a source of income. And I used to give speeches and said, look, why don't you get your income the old fashioned way by using speed traps? As these are traps that catch cars speeding through their town, and leave solar out of this because they would charge several thousand dollars, inspection fees, all these other fees. Whereas I looked at Germany and said, it all seems to be online, seamless, to actually help businesses and homeowners put solar on their roof. And so there were many things that were different in the way the United States promoted solar versus Germany. Some states are catching up, but still, it's still, you know, how do you make it seamless? How do you make it so that if people want to put solar, that the minimal licensing fees, inspections, for example, I used to say that if you want to install a hot water heater in your home, let's suppose it's a gas heater, then the rules are that there needs to be an inspector to make sure the gas plumbing was hooked up correctly. But other than that, if the water heater leaks, that's between you and your plumber. And similarly, my feeling was if you hook up solar on the rooftop, you need an inspector to make sure that it will interface with the grid, the distribution system, in a way that doesn't break it down or harm it in any way. If the roof leaks, that's between you and the installer. And so, you know, I was urging that we have the minimum amount of responsible inspection, and the rest is up to the individual contract between you, the installer, and the government shouldn't be part of that.
What also came to mind when you've been talking, because when you talked about the sun, I vividly remembered the high temperatures when I was attending college in Texas. I do believe you also do have some other challenges in terms of when you want to use solar energy. I'm thinking of states like Arizona, Texas, and Nevada, and so on and so forth. And then you need all the technology to get this really transported for long distances. I'm thinking, for example, California, New York, and the other urban areas. Maybe even Chicago, because apparently they also don't have a lot of good sun there.
Well, that is absolutely true. If you look at the solar map, the southwestern United States, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Nevada, superb solar, really, really some of the best around the world. There are a few other places that are slightly better, but we do need the transportation grid. We also are beginning to see that, for example, in California, which is now 70% of our electricity is carbon free. And we're installing more solar, but there's now so much solar that at noontime, when the sun is at its peak, there's beginning to be a surplus of solar energy. And so California is trying as much as can to start to build utility scale batteries at the tens of gigawatts and gigawatt hour capacity. But there's going to be an issue because as you pointed out, that part of the United States can have very, very hot summers. The peak of the air conditioning would be around 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, not at noontime. And so you have an excess of renewable energy at noon. And then there's a sudden ramp up we'd need that would be at the level of 3, 4, 5 gigawatt in terms of power ramping up in a few hours. And so this is, again, another one of the challenges when you have a big economy, and also to take advantage of solar, you still need a lot of energy storage. And Germany, every country who wants to go above 50% renewable, 60, 70%, hopefully even higher, then storage becomes a key. And utility scale storage has to be much more reliable than storage in an electric vehicle. Car breaks down, it's okay. You know, it's, you know, say one in a million cars will break down. But if you get a blackout, that's less okay. And so those are some of the requirements. I don't know. It's been estimated in order to get 3 days storage in the United States, and 3 days will actually allow us to go to 80% renewable. And 3 days doesn't sound like much, but we are barely at the one day storage. And so the difference between one day and 3 days is you effectively use your asset, your battery, one out of 3 days. And so the economic demand on a lower cost energy storage becomes higher and higher. You go to a 1 month storage. What does that mean? Do you use your asset once a month? And finally, seasonal storage. The only seasonal storage we have is actually hydroelectric power. And, you know, you would try to maximize the hydroelectric power you do have, but it's geography dependent and not all places have good mountains. For example, Germany does not have the mountains that Norway and Switzerland and even Austria have.
Oh yeah, Austria. I interviewed a guest there. He's his startup is in construction, and he told me, "Yeah, we have maybe in a good year 7 months of construction going on." Before we move on, I was curious when you were talking about solar. Do you have solar panels on the roof of your house?
Yes, this is an embarrassing question. The answer is no. What we do is we're in. We have a ranking of how much electricity families use. My wife and I the children are gone. And so we are in the lowest 10% of energy use in our area. And the question is, do I put in solar? Do I have an EV? Things of that nature. I probably will put in solar. It's not going to actually have any economic return for me because the payback might be 10, 15 years. I'm not sure I'll be living in this house in 15 years. But I will probably put in solar in the next year. I have another conundrum with my car. It's 22 years old. I only drive it 1,200 miles a year. The question is, why do I even own a car? I ride my bicycle to work. Errands anything less than a few miles, I'll ride my bicycle. I can do this in California because most of the time the weather's very good. But the short answer to your question is not yet in terms of solar. But the problem was our roof has a Spanish tile. Roof, and most solar installers won't touch that. And so finally, I did look into it a year ago and found that in order to install this on a Spanish tile roof, you actually have to take off the Spanish tiles, replace it with some lookalike concrete tiles, and then they're willing to put solar on the roof. So it's a much bigger deal. But I will do this.
By the way, I actually know how you're feeling. When I went to college, during my apprenticeship, high school and so on and so forth, I needed a car and I kept it until it was 25 and it was almost breaking apart.
Well, this car is in good shape. It only has 75,000 miles and I inherited from my wife. It's an old BMW 325. That car, you know, 75,000 miles, that car will go at least 200,000 miles. Hopefully it will be the last car I own in my life. If it breaks down, then I will buy an electric vehicle. But I don't drive it very much at all.
Considering your extensive background in your renewable energy and your role in initiatives like ARPA-E, what do you believe are key factors that will drive the next wave of successful energy startups in both U.S. and Europe?
Well, I think the experience we've had in ARPA-E, where we've funded a number of companies, they're successful in the usual startup definition, meaning after, let's say, 8 years, 10 years, they could have $1 billion valuation. They have a runway of $300 or $400 million, 3 years to do something. And when I look at those companies, I see they've just begun. There's at that level, there is not massive deployment. And so if you think about where we need to be, I've been spending a lot of time thinking, how do you get from this billion-dollar valuation, $300 million of cash runway, dozens of people, but really not at the scale you need to begin to really change carbon emissions and energy use. And so you need, the next step would be much larger investments. Typically, the investors in a startup company, the old mentality is that you want to maximize your investment. You don't want to share IP. The best of all possible worlds, either you become fabulously successful like Google, or you get bought up by a big company for, I'm going to make up a number, you know, $1 billion. It's good for the investors, but it's the big companies that have the real resources, financial resources. And so how do you team up these innovative startups with the bigger companies that might have more inertia so that you have a combination of financial assets, more connection to markets, but you have the innovative energy and drive and hard work of a small startup? You know, if I look at people who work at startups, they're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. You're in a big company, you have regular hours.
I see. The last question was actually inspired. You gave an interview to the German newspaper FAZ. They made the headline something, if the Greens were reasonable, they would prefer nuclear energy. So my question is, how do you view the future of nuclear energy with a broader context of renewable energy sources, especially when comparing the strategies and policies in place in the US and Europe?
Okay, this is a very important question. There is a lot of strong opinions and sentiments about nuclear. Many of them are against nuclear, but for a variety of reasons. But the question really is, suppose you want to get to as high a fraction of renewables as possible. And energy storage, as I said, and distribution and transmission are issues. But in the end, I think you would still need some compact turn-on source of energy for electricity. And I see that in the future as being either natural gas or nuclear. I don't see coal in the long term as having much of a future. It's very dangerous in particulate matter. It's very polluting. And with natural gas, you need to be able to capture the carbon dioxide and sequester it. But it's also known that when you're drilling for natural gas, recovering it, 2 to maybe 6% of the natural gas comes out of the ground. And in the capture of the carbon dioxide, you're capturing 90%, maybe 92%, but you're not going to capture 95%. So there's always an overhead there. And then finally, the sequestration of the carbon dioxide is not trivial. The amount of carbon dioxide you actually have to sequester safely is huge compared to the amount of spent fuel you have to sequester. Now, the conundrum about nuclear, besides there are some fears, I do my best to try to explain that, and most people don't realize that, for example, in the food you eat, roughly 30 or 40% of it is in radioactivity in the food. This is naturally occurring radioactivity in, for example, potassium that occurs in meat and bananas and many things we eat, green vegetables. The health people, the federal FDA, say there's recommended daily requirements for potassium, but it's not a question of actually endangering your health. The radioactivity levels, depending on your diet and where you live, could vary by factors of 3 or 4, this background radiation, and there's no correlation at all between that and cancer. So at these very low levels, it's not a danger. And so one of the things that people need to be assured of is the chance of a contamination is very small. I believe it can be made even smaller. The radioactive waste disposal, if I look at countries like Finland and Sweden, they're making good progress in spent fuel. And it's compact and it's carbon free. Now, despite all of that, what has happened is we've forgotten how to build large nuclear reactors on budget, on time. And as long as they are very expensive and have a possibility of going over budget, and the more recent ones have gone over budget, we're talking $10 billion per 1 gigawatt electrical power. You go over budget by 50%, that $5 billion extra is a huge financial hole. So the industry has to learn how to build them on budget, on time. I personally think there's another approach. I've been advocating this since 2010, where you make small modular reactors instead of a gigawatt to 1.5 gigawatts. They're 100 megawatts. They're factory made, so they can be on much more stringent conditions. But the most important thing is, instead of building them one at a time, imagine that you can start with 1,000 orders, and you go and maybe several models, and you have these small modular reactors. There's a rule in business called a learning curve. It's not a fundamental rule of science, but the more you produce, the better you are at lowering the manufacturing costs. And there's also steady improvements. And so what happens in learning curves is, if, for example, you double the number of units, the price, the manufacturing cost goes down by a certain percentage. You double again, it goes down by a certain percentage. So that means that if you're going up by factors of 10 in shipping out things, the cost goes down by some slope. It's a percentage, so it's an exponential decline. This is well known in all manufacturing. When Tesla was making Model S's and selling 5 or 10,000 a year, they were losing money, even though the cars cost $100,000, $120,000. They make the Model Y, Model 3, they cost $50,000, $60,000, but they're selling 500,000, making lots of money. And so the idea of a learning curve is true at everything except a few things like nuclear. Nuclear, because there's big projects and just a few big projects. So I say, let's turn it around. Let's make lots of little guys in factories that you can ship on a truck. After 10 years, you ship it back, you refuel it, you ship it. So it's inherently much safer. It could even be designed that it would be seamless to take these smaller modular reactors and deal, integrate that with the spent fuel issue. In the end, now there are at least a dozen startup companies looking at small modular reactors. There's also a few countries, China, Russia, for example, are doing these. But I think that could be a way to decrease any risk of contamination. There's always some risk, but you make it very, very small. And so the risks, for example, of getting on an airplane, flying somewhere, people don't really think I may die. it's so small that, and whenever there's an incident, a near miss, something, or even a crash, the whole world looks at what happened and tries to figure out what happened. And so that ethic and that way of promoting safety, year after year after year, decade after decade, airplane flight is getting more and more safe. The same thing could be true of nuclear. And maybe this learning curve model of making lots of them will enable the cost to go down. But you need those things, and you need public trust that the chance of contamination is very, very small. Now, burning anything, whether it's natural gas or coal is the worst because of the particulate matter. But if you look at the danger of various forms of energy per unit energy that's produced per terawatt hour, nuclear is perhaps thousands of times more dangerous. Sorry, coal is thousands of times more dangerous than nuclear because of particulate matter. In the studies, nuclear is as safe as wind and solar. It's 100 times safer than burning wood pellets that some European countries do because of the particulate matter. So these are things that hopefully as we understand the climate risks and how important they are, and there has to be some compact turn-on source of power, just in case you run out of battery storage, you need something. And I think that nuclear should be part of the future energy source.
I do believe that at one point we need to realize the tornadoes, the hurricanes, the storms, the floodings, and so on and so forth, they'll only get worse if we don't change our way of living. And I believe at one point we need to do a more radical change, especially in our energy production, where Germany did the interesting step of getting rid of all nuclear power. So not sure about, as a final question, of your opinion of that. What do you believe will happen? Are we going to reactivate them or have a lot of smaller nuclear power plants here in Germany at one point in the future?
Well, that's a difficult question, and I don't really know the details. When I talk with people in Germany, once a nuclear power plant is shut down for a few years, they say, no, it's difficult to start up. There was a time when there were, and they were not that old. The United States, for example, is going ahead, and for most of the power plants, with a few exceptions, meaning that these cities grew near these power plants, nuclear power plants, most of the power plants, nearly 100 in the United States, are going to be relicensed for another 20 years. The initial licensing was 40 years, but it was a very conservative licensing. And the Nuclear Regulatory Agency Commission is methodically going through and on a reactor by reactor basis, making a determination. Are they going to be safe for another 20-year operation? And so far, for the most part, virtually all of them are. I think the same could have been done for the German reactors, but what's done is done. And now the question is it feasible to restart? That I have to honestly say, I would have to talk to the people who just mothballed these reactors. Starting a new generation of reactors, it's not going to make an influence on carbon emissions for 10 or 20 years. You're looking at a lead time of getting approval for any new modular reactor. A large reactor is typically a decade from the time you decide we're going to build it to the time you can turn it on, if it doesn't meet delays. And so where are we are, but it's a very, very different place because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And essentially a rearming of NATO. We seem to be going back to a very Cold War mentality. And then the question is, before it was going to be cheap Russian gas, it's going to be the transition of the German energy. If you use liquefied natural gas, it's more expensive. And then again, that has to be folded in. If the energy prices in Germany go too high, I'm afraid that many of your heavy industries, much of your wealth creation is in automobiles, steel, chemicals. These are heavily energy intensive industries. And so if you want to remain competitive as a supplier of these materials, energy costs cannot go up that much. I think nuclear can play a role in this, especially if one doesn't want to turn back to Russian gas. And there are very complicated reasons why you might not want to do that.
I do believe we don't want to do that. Professor Chu, it was a pleasure having you as a guest. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And I wish you all good luck.
Thank you. Good luck with the car and your solar panel installation.
Okay, right. Bye.
Goodbye. Bye-bye.
That's all, folks. Find more news, streams, events, and interviews at www.startuprad.io. Remember, sharing is caring.